Well, welcome to the Collector Show for another week. I'm Harold Nickel. Coming up in the interview segment of the program is an interview with a woman whose name is Rebecca Kaufman. And Rebecca is a world-class Steiff bear collector. She, like so many of our guests, started out collecting as a young person, and she has found a way to turn her interest in Steiff into a full-time job. She's an appraiser, a dealer, a collector, and a very interesting individual. You'll want to stay tuned for that. And then later in the program, our friend Larry Zale talks to us about drawings and how ink drawings can give us some special insight into the personalities and lives of the artists. You won't want to miss that. First, as always, the news from the world of collecting. And this sounds like it's potentially a delicious but even messy collectible, Doctor Who. The Doctor Who collectible chocolate bars are now available for sale, but so far I'm only seeing them listed in the UK. I'm not seeing them for sale here in the US. But it looks like there's one for each Doctor, with the 11th featuring all of them. So I guess you could eat the chocolate and hang on to the sticker, or you could keep all of them unopened. Kind of like what we did with our baseball cards when we were kids. And I'm hoping that the chocolate tastes better than the gum did. That gum would slice right through your cheek. So that's one new thing in the world of collecting, Doctor Who. And then Culvilles has Halloween lanterns. Halloween lanterns, and it was just Halloween, although the show is evergreen. So, and you can collect Halloween stuff year-round. But lanterns are among the earliest Halloween collectibles, and not just jack-o'-lanterns. In the early 1900s, the jack-o'-lantern was made out of metal, because if you remember the story right, the jack-o'-lantern was really supposed to be a lantern. So this was an early version of what is now made from a pumpkin, but they made them out of metal because the paper versions, which they had originally made, caught fire. Not a surprise there. So these kinds of lanterns and lampshades were made for display, early in the 20th century through the 20s. And then they were made in a stained glass style to, you know, look like a lantern, because the story was that the guy who had the jack-o'-lantern had to wander the earth until the end of time. So that's where those came from. Not surprisingly, these original metal lanterns are $500 if you find one. So if you got one handy, you can cash in. Now, this is something that we talk about a lot on the show, authenticity. There's a controversy in Florida about a fellow who has 4,600 autographed baseballs. The name of his museum is Little Cooperstown. It's located in St. Petersburg, but there have been some questions about the authenticity of many of the balls, because it was found that one is fake, and one in particular that would be of interest to collectors was one that had been signed by Joe DiMaggio and Marilyn Monroe. And you'll remember that Jolton Joe was married to Marilyn for a time, but it turns out it's not true and is raising questions about this huge collection of autographed baseballs. The museum recently opened a $300,000 exhibit, and they're going to go on with it in spite of questions that have been raised about the authenticity of many of these autographs. And the reason I bring it up is because when you're collecting, buying, acquiring, you want to be sure to check on the authenticity. Okay, more of the Collector Show coming up.
Well, it's the interview segment of the Collector Show, and this week we are very fortunate to be joined by a veteran collector of Steiff stuffed toys. Rebecca Kaufman is joining us this week, and Rebecca, welcome to the Collector Show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to speak with you and your listeners.
Well, we're delighted to have you and looking very forward to learning about your collection. Tell us about your history as a collector. What were the first things you collected, and what was it that caused you to get started in collecting in general?
Sure. Well, I've been collecting for about 40 years, which is most of my life, and I am the third generation Stife collector in my family. My grandmother collected, and my father did a little bit as well. So it was inevitable that the gene would be passed on to me. I think the first items that I received as Stife or was collecting as Stife were itty-bitty teddy bears, and probably because I was an itty-bitty girl. These were very small bears, like 10 centimeters, which is about three or four inches. And it just really grew from there.
I didn't know, by the way, that's a wonderful turn of a phrase, that your 3 to 4 inch teddy bear collection grew. But
well, now I have bears as big as like 8 feet in my living room, so it's quite true.
So, man, an 8 foot bear. So, as a third generation collector, the knowledge that you picked up from your forebears must have been considerable.
Well, not only did I always love Stife, but I was always really fascinated with Germany and the German culture and the history of Stife. So it wasn't even work to learn how to do this and learn about the history and evolution of the products and the design and the Stife family and such. It's always just been of great interest, and I think I've been really fortunate that not only am I a collector and loves what I collect, but I actually love other collectors and talking to other collectors. And I think that makes what I do for Stife as their archivist a really good match.
I want to get into your work as an archivist and your ability to turn your interest and avocation into a vocation. But I want to go back to what you said about your interest in Germany. One of the things folks may not know, or maybe they do, but I'm going to talk about it anyway, is the fact that so much of what we celebrate, particularly at Christmas time, and the invention of children's toys, both came from Germany. Is that part of what got you interested?
Well, I've always been interested in Germany because my grandparents are from Germany, and I've always loved the food and the culture associated with it. Christmas is a really important part of Stife and the Stife culture, and Stife does a lot of work these days to promote Christmas and have items for Christmas. As early as the turn of last century, Stife used animals on Christmas trees as advertising for sort of Christmas purchases. It wasn't until probably the mid-1980s that Stife actually started creating Christmas tree ornaments. Stife has always, though, created Christmas-y type of items for the line.
And it's fair to say that, like all toy companies, that the Christmas season is the most important one in terms of sales, right?
Well, absolutely, but it sort of kind of ties with Easter. Easter's really, really big in Germany, and Stife has always created a spring line with lots of bunnies.
No kidding. I had no idea. I want to talk about that some more, too. But in terms of your work with Stife, you started out collecting, and the items in your collection grew from 3 inches to 8 feet in terms of size of toys. How did you decide to take it from hobby to vocation?
Well, I think it was a slow evolution. I think one is especially blessed if they can do for a living what they truly love. And I've always, as I said, I've always loved this brand. About 10 years ago, I saw an ad in the paper to work at Stife as a marketing manager. And honestly, I didn't even know that Stife was in North America. Not only that, but it was in the same state as I was. It's a very long commute, but I applied for the job, and I took along with me to the job interview my grandmother's 50-centimeter teddy bear as my companion, and he sat with me in the interview. And I think maybe that either made them think I was crazy or really passionate, but I did get the job, and I worked there for many years full-time as the marketing manager and just loved it. Things changed a little bit, and my interest changed a little bit, and I left the company but continued to do a lot of writing for them. And then a couple of years ago, they called me and said, listen, we know your passion and your interest is in vintage items, and you're really good at building community. So would you be responsible for helping us with the archival programs here at Stife, which would mean things like identification and valuation of vintage items and talking to collectors about their collection, and also writing extensively for the Worldwide magazine, which has a circulation of about 60,000.
Wow. You know, it's funny because you read my mind when you said that they would think I was either really interested or crazy.
It's a fine line.
Yeah, and I I'm not sure that there is any other occasion where it would ever be appropriate to take a stuffed bear on a job interview, unless you were interviewing for a job like the one that you got.
Well,
but it must have worked.
Well, that's true, but sort of offline, I recently read within the last year that the study was done out of the Harvard Business School that showed if a teddy bear was located in the room, people were nicer to each other and came to better negotiation results.
Wow. I'm gonna go find my teddy bear.
Bring a teddy bear to your next salary negotiation or something like that.
I think it's a good idea. And if you didn't get the raise, then you might get better medical or something. But
yeah, anyway,
so you progressed from marketing manager to archivist.
Correct.
So my thought is that if there are enough of these things that they need to be archived, there must be an awful lot of stiff animals available or toys available.
Well, what I do primarily for the company is I do an extensive amount of traveling to events, and that would be both domestically and internationally. And I meet with collectors, and oftentimes they'll bring me things, or they'll have an appointment to bring me something special. I do a tremendous amount of work online, and of course you can't really identify and value something unless you hold it in your hands. But you can get a general sense of the era of the piece and its condition and an approximate valuation. You know, again, you do have to see things in person. But there is a tremendous amount of interest. I probably get 20 to 30 emails a day of people who have either collections or items they'd like me to take a look at or value, or just tell them if it's, you know, trash or treasure, as people say.
Right.
You know, at events, people bring wonderful things. I've had people bring in life-size zebras to events to have me look at. I've had people bring me in little woolen animals the size of a golf ball to look at. It's the whole range. I think people have a very passionate attraction to this brand because it has so much legacy to it, and most people are multi-generation collectors.
That's so interesting because one of the things that we've talked about in the past on this program is just the opposite, in that children of collectors or heirs or people who stand to receive significant and important collections after the original collector passes away have very little interest, but it sounds like Stiff has a different model.
Well, yes and no. I think Stiff is an exceptional brand. First of all, it's really cute.
Yeah.
You can't help but love teddy bears, and I think there's something very nostalgic about that. There's a difference with somebody collecting something like Thimbles or Hummels or whatever it is. It might not have a personal attraction, but it's really hard not to fall in love and find space for a few teddy bears. I think it has that going for it. No offense to other collectibles. On the other side of the coin, I'm also a global broker of Stiff, meaning I have customers all over the world who I buy and sell for, and that's another important part of my business. And for better or for worse, very, very often people come to me with very large collections because they don't have heirs or they don't have someone in their family who's interested. So it really sort of folds both ways, which is good for the collectors because it means I can constantly refresh the market with new things or participate in that. But it's sometimes sad when people present me collections because I think, well, are you sure? And I always ask people before I take something on, are you sure you want me to either buy this from you or sell it? Because once it's gone, it's gone, and I can't get it back for you. So I'm especially diligent about asking about that during any transaction I have when I'm buying something.
And it sounds like you have a special sensitivity because of your background as business person, but collector first.
Well, exactly, and I think that's how I run my business. That's how I run my work for Stiff, that's how I run other opportunities that I do, because I am a collector and I have a really deep, I know what it's like to find that piece. I know what it's like to have the piece that got away. I know what it's like to you know, find that you have a piece that you love that has damage on it. I know all those feelings, and I just want to make sure that collectors love what they purchase and are happy with their purchase and are at peace when they have to sell something, because it gets personal, and I just, you want to keep people as happy as possible.
Sure. Now, my idea is that because of the fact that there's a connection to childhood, that's likely what makes Steiff toys such good collectibles. Am I on the right track?
Well, I think so. And it's definitely a global phenomenon. In Germany, I've been told that when a child is born, it's inevitable that he receives a Steiff toy. And that Steiff in Germany has the name recognition of, say, McDonald's or Disney. Here in the U.S., it's a little bit different. But I still think that there is an enormous bond. And I think you're right, because of the childhood connection. It becomes just a part of who you are.
I want to kind of go back to what you were saying about Germany and what we were talking about Christmas earlier. I'm a very avid Christmas ornament collector, and one of the things that I've learned in studying that is that the times during the First and Second World War and afterwards really harmed the ornament manufacturing industry, if you could call it that, and that so much of the art and molds and skill associated with manufacturing ornaments was just lost. Was there a similar occurrence with Steiff?
Well, I can give you an analogous situation, and as an archivist, this is one way that we date items, is that we look at the materials that were used on items. Now, Steiff didn't, per se, make ornaments until you know, much after that period, but during the war and just before, and just the Steiff did not produce items during World War, did not produce toy items during World War II. They did a little bit during World War I. The whole idea, where Steiff is located, is in Gingen, Germany, which is in the southern part of Germany, and it's a really rural area. And so supply chain management of goods to in and out of the factory was challenging. And so right around just before and just after World War I, and a little bit before and after World War II, Steiff would change the materials on items. For example, just before World War II started, felt was really hard to get for toy manufacturing purposes. It was being used for other items. So Steiff, instead of putting felt pads on the bears, would put linen pads, or would put like a canvas pad. So as an archivist, when you look at an item and it looks normal but it has strange pads, it might be because it was produced during that time when those materials weren't available. Steiff also, during right after World War I, created a really interesting plush out of wood. It was called wood plush and was literally made from trees because there was no mohair available.
Huh.
So Steiff has always been very industrious. Did something with silk plush, which is a lower quality sort of manufactured material for teddy bears as well. And that was all those items were used on bears during periods of hardship.
So my guess is that those toys that were made, and you can recognize them based on the description you just gave us, that those are likely more valuable?
Absolutely. And I think they fewer were made. And they have a really distinctive configuration in terms of the materials, and the time period in which they were made are of key interest to sort of these uber collectors, or people who are really interested in tying the history of a piece to the period in which it was made and what the piece looks like. It's a wonderful period to collect, although the pieces are few and far between.
And I appreciate the use of the German lingo there with the uber Steiff collector.
Uber collector.
Yeah. So let's shift gears a little bit to now.
Okay.
Where might one see a significant collection of Steiff animals?
Okay. The very best place on the planet, and it's worth a pilgrimage, and I use that word lovingly, is in Basel, Switzerland. There's the best museum I've ever in my life seen. It's called the Puppenhaus Museum. It's the Dollhouse Museum, but it's literally... It's several floors of the most exquisite Steiff you've ever in your life seen, and and any time at auction that a fabulous piece comes up to auction, there's a very, very good chance that a buyer from the Puppenhaus Museum is there. They just have the most outstanding collection of bears from really the turn of last century until today, and it's just fantastic.
Relative to Zurich, where is Basel?
It's probably an hour and a half car ride.
Okay, so not far.
And worth the trip. I've been twice. And the museum, the exhibits change a little bit, so you always see something new and they're always buying. It's a most exciting place. If you are really a passionate collector, I would dedicate at least a day or two to really walking the floors of the Puppenhaus Museum. It was kind of an emotional event for me because there was a very large Seyss auction in October of 2010, and there were some fabulous pieces, and I didn't know who got them or where they went. And then we went back to the Puppenhaus in June of 2012. They were all displayed in a special area in the Puppenhaus Museum as part of the results of that auction. So, you know, it's like family.
Sure. And for those of us who don't get to Switzerland as often as we might, is there any place in the U.S. where we might be able to see a Steiff collection?
Well, my house.
Okay, let's get an address.
there is not as much of a emphasis on large collections here in the United States. There is a wonderful museum in the Albany, New York area called the Margaret Strong Museum, and I know that they do have a very nice collection of Steiff and vintage Steiff, and that would be sort of in the upstate New York area.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally when Steiff does its events, an archival display will be part of that. So if you check out the Steiff USA website, you might see some events listed in there. There might be some archival events associated with that. And once every couple of years, Steiff does a big United States sort of archival tour with a larger event. Last year at FAO Schwarz, in honor of the 150th anniversary of that store, my Steiff colleagues and I did a really large event for Steiff and FAO Schwarz, where we brought in, I think it was about, 25, 50 pieces from the actual Steiff archives, and had that on exhibit, and then I did appraisals for that event, and that was kind of a bucket list thing.
Yeah, it sounds like fun. I've had the opportunity to visit FAO Schwarz in New York City, and of course they have stores all over the place now, but once upon a time, that was the only store you could go to.
Well, exactly, and FAO Schwarz has a special place in my heart as well. The great-granddaughter of FAO Schwarz is a good friend of mine, so I've learned about the company from really the family perspective. But FAO Schwarz and Steiff are often in the Steiff world, are synonymous, as many people got their first Steiff, touch of Steiff at FAO Schwarz.
I'll bet that's right. Now, what's before we run out of time, what's new for the holiday season this year for people who are already Steiff collectors or for those who might be interested in starting one?
Well, I think, as we discussed, Christmas is a wonderful time to give and receive Steiff. And as a matter of fact, one of the articles I wrote for the Christmas magazine is what I want to see under my Christmas tree, that's Steiff. So it's universal. People who love Steiff universally have a Steiff item on their wish list. I think the best item in the line of the new items this year is a wonderful white bear. And we often partner with other major brands like, for instance, Yadro or Swarovski to do sort of bears with elements of that sort of luxury good as part of their construction. And this year we again continue our series with Swarovski, and we have a beautiful white polar bear that's wearing a beautiful red crystal, which is like an ornament in itself, and it's very, very seasonal. It would look beautiful on a Christmas table. And that bear is called Berry, like cranberry, because
right.
The item looks like a berry. And we also have some beautiful little ornaments for the tree as well.
That sounds like fun, and as an ornament collector, I'm going to definitely be checking those out myself. Now, if listeners would like to be in touch with you, Rebecca, how might they do that?
Well, I write a weekly blog about vintage Steiff, and a lot of the content is based on my collection, but a lot of it is also based on readers' questions, people who send me things. So if you have a question about something, you might just see it on the blog. My blog is called My Steiff Life. That's all one word, and it's on the Blogspot platform, and all of my contact information is as part of My Steiff Life, and There you can see, you can read the articles over the past, I think it's 5 or 6 years. There's also links to how to get in touch with me about questions. And I also run a store on Ruby Lane, which is a store, which is an online platform for fine arts and antiques and collectibles. And I always list beautiful vintage type items for sale there as well. So if you're dreaming of something, I might just have it listed there. Or if you're dreaming of something, just email me and perhaps I can find it for you.
Okay. Well, visit My Stife Life to be in touch with Rebecca Kaufman. Rebecca, thanks for being on the Collector Show this week. It's been really interesting to chat with you.
My pleasure. I hope you learned something about bears and maybe even fell in love with Stife.
Absolutely. And loved them anyway. So thanks again for being on. It's Web Talk Radio, the Collector Show. Come back for more.
Well, it's a time on the Collector's Show when we speak with our good friend Lawrence C. Zale, who is an expert in lots of different types of collecting and collectibles and fine artwork. And Larry, as he's nice enough to let us call him, is going to take up with us where he left off last week. And Larry, welcome back to the Collector's Show.
Harold, thanks again for having me. It's a pleasure.
So, Larry, last week we were chatting and ran out of time and agreed that we needed a second part of the discussion. And if memory serves, we were talking about drawing, and specifically, I believe it was pen and ink drawing. Is that right?
Well, we were talking about different types of drawings. Pen and ink would be one example. But what I thought would be helpful, Harold, if it's all right with you and listeners, is just to quickly summarize paintings and drawings, and then we can talk today about the techniques of printmaking.
That sounds terrific.
Great.
So from last week, you'll lead us into this week.
Yes, because it can be a bit confusing, especially for newer collectors. Paintings are generally of three types. They're water-based, which are the most popular. They're known for their ease of use, rapid drying, and lightening of color as it dries. Then you have oil-based, which is usually comprised of vegetable oils, or it could include, in older paintings, linseed or walnut or even safflower oil. And the elements of oil-based painting is that it's a flexible medium, so that they have the ability to go into greater detail than they would, say, for water-based painting. And then the third is encaustic, and you may recall your question to me that the wax, which is the primary component, if it's the kind of wax that you would find from a candle, and it is much the same.
That's right. I do remember that.
And what happens is that the wax tends to stiffen, and it gives somewhat of a matte finish. It is not terribly popular, but from time to time it's used. And then when we get to drawings, it becomes a very, very personal medium. It's probably the most personal of all of the arts. It's defined, I would say, Harold, less by the degree of finish than by its media. Or as the art experts like to say, is the triumph of line over color. So if you're someone who enjoys a good deal of color in your works, drawings would probably not appeal to you.
I guess the kind of drawings I'm most familiar with, and likely the listeners are as well, are cartoons. Is that
right?
Is that a decent example, or is there more?
Well, there are drawings that date back to the Renaissance up to the present day. Cartoons would be one example. But to keep in mind that with drawings, because it is so personal, it tells you a great deal about the artist and his or her intentions. if they're doing, say, an oil painting, for example, a history painting or a portrait, there are other issues at play, usually trying to please the patron or the person who's paying for the work.
Uh-huh.
But when it comes to drawings, it is so very personal that the artist or the creator tells you a great deal about him or herself.
I had wondered when you had said that it was the most personal medium what you meant, and it sounds like there's, if there's not a customer involved, for lack of a better term, that the artist can express him or herself in a way that they like or that's most appropriate for them. Is that a fair statement?
Generally so. They are often used for works that would be transferred into a larger work, oil on canvas, for example. But oftentimes, artists or creators were happy just to have the drawings themselves, and they tell a great deal about the artist's intentions, his or her ability to draw and to capture that moment, which is so appealing to viewers.
So from a collector's point of view, with respect to these different types of art that we've discussed today, this week, and of course last week, what are some conclusions that collectors can take away from that?
I'd be delighted to give you that answer, but may I include some of the techniques that go into printmaking, which would be the third element?
Oh, absolutely. I apologize for skipping to the end. Yes, please do.
Great. I'll be brief. With printmaking, they're generally divided into three, perhaps four categories. I say perhaps four because the last is not used as frequently as the others. The first would be relief. Think of it as where the ink is applied to an original surface, and such as like a woodcut or a woodblock, and it is cut into that area, like a wood engraving or a lino cut or a metal cut. So what happens is that the relief stands up. Think of it as being above the surface. The fancy Italian word, intaglio, is just where the ink is applied beneath the original surface. So think of it as going below the surface. So the relief is above, the intaglio is a bit below.
Mm-hmm.
And the third is the planographic, which retains its original surface, which is generally like prepared or inked to allow for the transfer of the image. And that would include, listeners will be familiar with, lithography or monotyping or even digital techniques. I know this sounds a bit technical, but listeners, I think, will appreciate the difference between the three.
Yes.
The fourth, we don't need to really go into detail, Harold, would be stencil. Generally speaking, that where the ink or the paint is pressed, through an area.
So for those of us who are not as familiar with these techniques, are there different things that we should look for if you're a novice and you want to start investing in or collecting these types of works?
That's an important question. Collectors, experienced or new, in my view, should continue to look at the images that appeal to them. Once they see those images that appeal to them, find out about the creator or the artist and other artists that are part of that particular circle or area of creativity, and begin to follow them. Once they follow them, they'll be able to determine other things that we discussed this morning, which one works best for them, and then to pursue it by following up with dealers, auction results, and reading on their own online or in their favorite area, whether it's a library or another reference, the information that appeals to them.
Yeah, and I think that really gets back to things that we talk about here quite a bit, and that's follow your own interests, and then as you suggest, do the research, because every work of art or collectible has a story, and find out what the story was, know more about what it is that you're collecting, and have a better experience as a collector, whether it's fine art or sculpture or coins or whatever your area of interest happens to be.
I agree.
Well, Larry, thanks. And tell us your website and how folks can get in touch with you directly if they would like.
Sure. My website is visualartsadvisory.com. My email is lczale@aol.com.
Excellent. And Larry, as always, thanks for your contributions to the Collector Show, because these last two conversations have really been eye-openers for me, and I'm sure they have for the listeners as well.
My pleasure.
Hey, let's talk about next week. We're going to talk about something we've never discussed before, furniture collecting, and specifically a type of furniture that requires weaving. Have you ever encountered caned or rush furniture, Larry, in your work?
Occasionally, Harold, but it doesn't occur often. But when it does, it tends to be very revealing and interesting.
Well, hopefully that's what we come back with next week when we talk about caned furniture. On the Collector Show here on Web Talk Radio, for my friend Larry Zale, I'm Harold Nickel. Come back next week.